Hello, I'm Alicia Lawyer, founder of Rocco, and these are the audio notes for our concert Beauty is in the Eye on February 8th at 5 p.m. Kevin Lau's piece, Between the Earth and Forever, written for Rocco, and this is the world premiere. Lau was inspired by a trip to NASA's Johnson Space Center, which awoke a fascination with exploration itself, as well as an admiration for the intrepid explorers who continue to venture beyond the boundaries of our planet, wading into the mystery of the cosmos on behalf of all humankind. But why choose the erhu as a solo instrument in a concerto inspired by space exploration? The composer cites one special, invisible thread which kept him tethered during the creative process, his grandfather, who himself played the erhu. This idea of a tethering thread, a temporary lifeline, is mirrored in a photograph whose caption lent this piece its name, a stunning picture of a Canadian astronaut venturing out of his ship on his first spacewalk, treading that gossamer infinite space between the Earth and forever. Name that instrument. The erhu is a traditional Chinese instrument dating back at least to the Tang Dynasty in the late first millennium. It is bowed like the violin, but has only two strings, and is played on the lap instead of on the shoulder. Like a drum, the front of the resonating body is covered with animal skin, and for the erhu, traditionally from a python, though in recent years, non-organic options have arisen. About Kevin Lau. Born in Hong Kong, Kevin moved to Toronto when he was 7. He was for 3 years the RBC affiliate composer at the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, and has written a number of works for ballet and film. Rocco audiences may remember his chamber work, The Nightingale, premiere from April 2018. There's a lot of extra percussion on this piece. The percussion section is fairly large. A few instruments you may not recognize, crotales, a series of metal discs played with traditional mallets, as well as a double bass bow, an anvil, metal designed to sound like an actual anvil, and a waterphone, a handheld idiophone with a series of metal rods. For further listening, check out The Nightingale, the performance of which is available for listening on Rocco Replay at rocco.org. Also on YouTube, find a recording of an erhu playing Franz Waxman's demanding Carmen fantasy, written for the violin but performed on this soulful instrument. William Grant Still's Darker America. Written in 1924, it was premiered in New York 2 years later. The piece still evokes the struggle of African Americans by juxtaposing three themes, an introductory theme of the American Negro, a sorrow theme, and finally a hope theme, which looks forward to equality and acceptance. In addition to the musical language, which incorporates the dialects of jazz and spirituals, Still uses a call-and-response technique familiar to the musical descendants of African music. Meet the composer. William Grant Still was born in deeply segregated Arkansas, and after attending college in Ohio, found work in New York, where he arranged for W.C. Handy while still finding time to study with such composers as George Whitfield Chadwick and Edgar Varèse. Darker America was his first success and led to a successful career as both composer and conductor. His catalog of works includes 5 symphonies and 8 operas. His was a career of firsts. He was the first African-American conductor to conduct a major American orchestra, the first to have an opera produced by a leading company, the New York City Opera, and the first to see his opera televised nationally. Hot music in the concert hall. Darker America was written the same year as Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, and just 1 year after Millot's La Création du Monde, both of which draw heavily on the jazz styles prevalent in Harlem at the time. The music scene in Harlem was on fire, and composers in both the New World and the Old immediately saw the vast possibilities in this new music. Looking back, it seems inevitable that jazz would enter the classical canon, and it makes us wonder how the music of today might successfully emerge in pieces being written right now. For further listening, Still is perhaps best known for his terrific Afro-American symphony, which incorporates American folk styles. Try listening to some of Duke Ellington's larger-scale works from a classical perspective, and you'll see how Still straddled that imaginary classical jazz divide just from the other side. Jean Ferry Rebel's Les Éléments, or The Elements. A 1737 dance symphony using facets of Greek mythology to describe the creation of the world. First performed in Paris without the initial movement in 1737, with dancers, performed in full the following year. The first movement shocks even the most modern audiences with its brash dissonance. Rebel includes a cluster, a clump of notes. Think of playing a piano with your palm or forearm. Then each of the element themes, one right after the other. The movement is more accurately descriptive of the early prehistorical process that Rebel might have realized. Right after we hear a big bang, the elements fly by, and only then do we begin to feel the comforting pull of musical gravity, tonality. The second movement depicts earth and water, the third fire. Next, in the fourth movement, we hear evocations of birdsong, with the implication of earth itself as a stabilizing force. The following movements are traditional dances, almost as if we now see the introduction of humanity with all its fancy dance moves. Jean-Ferry Rebel was the son of a singer in the private chapel of Louis XIV. After study with Jean-Baptiste Lully, an official court composer at Versailles, Rebel quickly moved up the ranks to the same position. As a composer, he kept abreast of international developments and introduced a number of Italian fashions, including a reliance on string sonatas and a new tendency to call multi-movement pieces symphonies. One of Rebel's early musical jobs was to lead a consort of players as batteurs de mesure. This involved not conducting, but beating time on the floor with a heavy stick. Incidentally, this very profession turned into conducting, but also led to the death of Rebel's teacher, Lully, who accidentally hit his own foot with the staff, the resulting gangrene spread, and he died. One imagines that Rebel would have been pretty careful after that. For further listening, another Baroque piece with surprising dissonance, please check out Bieber's Battaglia, which features a musical approximation of a chorus of drunken soldiers. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, Masonic Funeral Music. Written in 1785 and performed in November at a Masonic funeral for a Viennese duke and count. Mozart isn't typically known to use musical quotations, but on the title page to his manuscript, he made a point of copying out the traditional plain chant melody, Lamentatio, which is sung during Holy Week. This theme is threaded throughout the piece. Mozart was admitted to the Viennese Lodge in late 1784 and was quickly promoted to the rank of Master Mason within a few months. This was a brilliant career move, as significant aristocrats were also members, and rubbing shoulders was good for business. Furthermore, Mozart enjoyed the company of the more rational faction of Masons, whose ideals were shaped by the Enlightenment, a faction which could incidentally come to be known as the Illuminati. Cue all the conspiracy theories. Interestingly, despite being one of the first freelance composers without a court-sponsored position, a decision he purposefully made as he found sponsorship stultifying, Mozart still knew to rely on the moneyed class. When he began Masonic funeral music, he had been a Mason for less than 1 year. He would go on to write a small handful of works for performances at gatherings of Masons. For further listening, Mozart's opera The Magic Flute famously includes Masonic references. Just for the fun of it, his cantata The Mason's Joy is a great alternative. The next three works are part of Rocco's 15 project, commissioning 15 diverse composers across the nation and internationally. The first piece by Alessandro Basulto, Fanfaria de Feria. In his own words, as a Mexican musician, the word fanfare has two different meanings. On the one hand, it refers to a piece of celebratory music usually performed by the brass and percussion, which is the usual interpretation. On the other hand, it is a particular tune ingrained in Mexico's popular culture, simply known as the fanfaria, Spanish for fanfare, or the diana. While both are performed by the same instrument forces, brass and percussion, and serve the same purposes, celebratory, the traditional and the Mexican fanfare have a very different character. The usual fanfare has this unmistakably highbrow and solemn affair. Even fast-paced fanfares share this grandiloquent sound. On the other hand, the Mexican fanfaria is unequivocally popular, lowbrow, and uncomplicated. I find it fascinating that while the Mexican fanfaria is technically speaking a fanfare, its character sets the piece apart in a very different realm. In my Fanfaria de Feria, which roughly translates into fair fanfare, I decided to paraphrase the Diana tune and create narrative tension between the highbrow and the lowbrow aspects of what I understand as a fanfare. Whistle while you work. The percussionist for this piece plays the usual battery of instruments, but includes two more fun ones, a police whistle and a slide whistle. What a job. For further listening, head to Roco Replay to hear more of Alejandro's music, including Triptico de Luz from earlier this season. Also, jig variations for guitar and chamber orchestra. The next piece on the 15 project for this concert is by Catherine Saalfelder. It is called Ephemera. In her own words, Saalfelder engages late medieval and Renaissance polyphony in conversations with 21st century techniques. She borrows both literally from chansons, motets, and masses, as well as more liberally from Renaissance-era forms and structures. She currently teaches at the New England Conservatory in Boston and previously taught at MIT. She writes that the noun ephemera commonly refers to items such as tokens, tickets, or pamphlets only designed to be useful for a short time. It also has a secondary, more intriguing definition: guests, visitors, or persons staying at an inn. The music embraces this latter definition. A cloud of string harmonics hovers in the background. Listen for the musical guests, triumphant piano chords who arrive immediately at the onset but depart after a brief stay. We are left with sweet yet faint memories of their short-lived visit. For further listening, check out Kate's beautiful Lux Perpetua, a concerto for soprano sax and orchestra commissioned by the Albany Symphony Orchestra. The last piece on our 15 project this concert is by Jess Langston Turner, Fanfares and Riffs for Tiny Despots. Meet Jess. Born in South Carolina, Turner is quickly becoming well-known in the world of wind band, and he writes for musicians at all levels. His music is rhythmically propulsive and gesturally dramatic. The 15-second summary. The tiny despots I originally had in mind while writing this piece were birds. Outside my window, there is a bird feeder, and most days there are several different types of usually male birds jockeying and posturing fiercely in order to protect their food from every other bird in the area. However, when each of these tiny despots are done eating, they fly off, and their miniature empires are left to the next little tyrant. This fanfare is dedicated to these, as well as the human tyrants that come and go just as quickly and shrilly as the tiny despots outside my window. For further listening, Jess's Dance Fairs is one of the most fun, engaging band pieces ever heard. It's a piece about earworms, little musical fragments that get stuck in our heads and won't dislodge. These audio notes for Roco are generously recorded by Catherine Liu at Houston Public Media. Please check out all of our offerings at roco.org and in all social media at Roco Houston.